that thrill of feeling the fish bite and then reeling it in and admiring the fish. It's just an easy way to connect with nature in an urban environment.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and before we get started, a quick note. This is the final episode of The Modern West as you know it. The show will relaunch in September with a new sound and a new host, and more info on all of that and how to subscribe at the end of this episode. It was John Steinbeck who once said, "All Americans believe that they are born fishermen. For a man to admit a distaste for fishing would be like denouncing mother love or hating moonlight." And to bring it up to date, we should say many women are loath to admit distaste for fishing, too. Fishing is one of the most popular outdoor activities in our region, and it brings people from all over the world to try and keep their cool while fly fishing in Yellowstone or the Bighorn River. So this time we'll hear how social media is affecting the fly fishing community and how warming temperatures are impacting ice fishing. To start, we'll hear how stocking fishing ponds is encouraging people to spend time outside and what that means for communities across the Mountain West. The Mountain West News Bureau's Judy Fays talked to people about what their local fishing hole means to them.
Willow Pond is like a lot of community fishing holes. It's in a suburban park beyond the soccer fields and a baseball diamond. Great blue herons are standing around, a pair of white pelicans too, but they seem oblivious to the racket from the highway nearby.
Daniel, do you like catching fish?
Uh-huh.
Antonio Cadena is fly casting. His son Daniel is 2.5. He's giving his toddler-sized spin casting rig a break.
Do you like big ones or little ones?
Big one, Dad.
Father and son spend a few mornings a week here.
I just want to make sure that he gets outdoors and that he doesn't grow up just watching TV all day every day. So he comes out here, he'll run around. He'll play with the ducks, and when we occasionally catch a fish or two, he likes to touch them.
Or take them home so they can be simmered in garlic butter and he can eat them.
I think it's good for him.
It's a sparkling spring day, and the Wasatch Mountains are a grand backdrop beyond the Salt Lake Valley. The grass and trees here are greening up. A few men huddle in the shade, travel mugs in hand.
There's a lot of us old retired guys that this is an outlet for us.
Jerry Weaver comes here most days.
Sometimes we fish, sometimes we just talk, you know, and we just hang out.
They talk about fishing when they were kids, how they'd spend long summer days outdoors, how their dads taught them.
It's kind of a family thing, too, you know.
That's fellow retiree and fishing buddy Glade Charlesworth.
Keeps families together and keeps them off the street, keeps them from crime and stuff.
They refurbish fishing poles from the thrift store. They use them to teach kids who come along and want to learn to fish. They call it giving back, but they also just get a kick out of it. You can tell. Another reason is rolling towards the pond. It's a boxy truck with a huge trout painted on the side. Inside are thousands of hungry rainbow trout from the state hatchery.
I'm going to put 1,400 fish into the pond.
Ryan Arthur is an aquaculturist for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. A small crowd watches as he climbs to the truck's side and dunks a big net into a hatch on the top of the tank. Arthur strains backward to lift up a net full of flopping fish. He flips the net. Trout tumble out.
Here in the city, we're kind of disconnected from, I think, a lot of the environment. But you can bring them to a park like this, explain to them, you know, the fish do need ideal water quality in order to survive. And I think it's a great way just to explain that and explain what habitats are. And
scenes like this are playing out all over the Mountain West. Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, and Idaho, they also stock community fishing holes in the spring and summer. The fish might not be wild, but the conservation group Trout Unlimited supports programs like these.
That thrill of feeling the fish bite and then reeling it in and admiring the fish.
That's Brett Prettyman with Trout Unlimited.
It's just an easy way to connect with nature in an urban environment. And we hope that helps them foster that passion and makes them want to pursue it when they get older and when they have the opportunity to actually get into nature in the wild and experience it out there.
That's exactly what's happening back at Willow Pond. The Cadenas are back on the fishing dock.
Oh my goodness. That's a good one.
It's not fishing on a wilderness river or on the ocean, but it gets them hooked on being outdoors.
Get taken.
Did you just jump up and down?
Huh?
Hanging out with friends and family, enjoying the natural world, advice about turning fishing into catching. It's all here on an ordinary day at the neighborhood pond. And without being preachy, it's helping teach the value of a healthy environment. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Judy Faze.
Urban fishing is exciting because it gets people outside and off of their phones. But there is some controversy surrounding how social media apps on your phone are shaping fly fishing. Social media has brought us lots of things, from Instagrammed food pics to the ubiquitous selfie and a tweeting president, and brand ambassadors. These are people who have a huge following on platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For a price, they will highlight certain company brands when they post. But one such ambassador has set off a huge upset in the world of fly fishing. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen has that story.
Ryan Hudson would describe himself as a bit of a hermit.
I don't like to deal with people. I hide out.
Hudson lives in the small town of Daniel, Wyoming, population 150. For the last 14 years, he's worked as a fly fishing guide. But a recent cover photo on the January edition of American Angler caused Hudson to step out of his quiet world and write an op-ed.
I just thought, boy, this is going to create a lot of nonsense in my life.
He was right. His op-ed criticizing the photo of a well-known angler and brand ambassador went viral. In the picture, the angler is showing off the roughly 2-foot-long brown trout he just caught.
The cover clearly depicted the bones coming out of that fish's tail. And
any skilled angler will tell you that means it's spawning. Fish are particularly vulnerable at this stage of their life cycle and easier to catch. Hudson says it's not unusual to see inexperienced anglers targeting them. It's not illegal. But for experienced anglers, it's a shady practice.
Why do we want to interrupt them when they are putting eggs in the ground that have a small chance of survival to begin with? That's why they lay hundreds, if not thousands, of eggs.
In his op-ed, Hudson said he's concerned by the lengths so-called brand ambassadors will go to get the perfect picture.
But social media, you know, it's your own personal bragging board. We all have the right to post a picture of something really cool we were just involved in.
But not, he says, if you have to do something unethical, like catch a spawning fish to get the shot. The angler at the center of this debate is Patrick Duke, a brand ambassador from Colorado. He declined our request for an interview, but in a public Facebook post, he apologized and said, quote, "I hope that those who know me as a person of high class and moral character will not formulate a new negative opinion about me or the brands that I am affiliated with."
Anytime you use a real person associated with a brand, they're a real person.
That's Elizabeth Mitten, a marketing professor at the University of Wyoming.
And they'll post information about, sometimes it's the brands that they're using, it's the activities that they're pursuing, it's the best spots that they're going to, it's their latest adventure. And a lot of times it will inspire the followers to try to do the same thing.
Brand ambassadors have made their way into almost every market, telling people how to dress, what to eat, and where to stay on vacation. Mitten says they're really effective for brands, especially smaller ones, because their followers are usually the exact consumers the company wants to reach. Mitten also says people are more likely to trust them.
They're perceived as unbiased, more trusted than a lot of other sources of advertising. And so that a smaller brand can get their name out there more easily and potentially increase sales that way.
Probably the most visible brand ambassadors in the angling world, though, are with Orvis, one of the oldest and largest fly fishing companies in the world. Company spokesperson Steve Hempkins says the company depends on brand ambassadors to help encourage newcomers to the sport.
It's not something that you just are going to wake up one day and say, I want to fly fish.
From gear to difficult techniques, it's a steep learning curve, and Hempkins says brand ambassadors are relatable and credible figures who can help newbies with those hurdles.
People look at what the signals that we send as an industry leader, and then they kind of use that to as guardrails for their own behavior.
Hempkins says Orvis does not support targeting spawning fish as part of that behavior, but he doesn't think brand ambassadors are to blame for an apparent uptick in unethical practices like this.
Everyone has a DSLR camera and their iPhone in their pocket. Many people carry really great cameras, and so there's tons of content flying around in every direction.
At the same time, he does say it will be up to the companies, the brands, to fix the problem.
We're not doing our industry, our shareholders, the fisheries any favors.
By putting untrained anglers on a crowded river, he says, an interest in fly fishing is on the increase. With more men and women wading out into moving rivers, ethical and sustainable fishing practices may become more of a moving target. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
The warming climate has parts of the world tiptoeing on thin ice. For an ice fisherman, that's no metaphor. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards went out with some longtime Wyoming fishermen who gave her some tips for staying safe on the ice as temperatures heat up.
On a pond in a top-secret spot on the Laramie Plains, I take my first steps out onto the ice behind fisherman Larry Foyanini. He tells me to walk right behind him. He points out some open water in the middle where a spring percolates, keeping it from freezing.
We don't want to be in this area at all down there.
Are you kind of looking at the color of the ice and seeing
well,
stuff?
Well, it's so clear you can see through it down here.
You can see how far down those bubbles are?
Yeah, you can see straight in. This is nice and clear. Yeah. But there's some big cracks here. That kind of freaks me out.
Oh, cracks are always there.
The cracks
ice
are always
expands
here?
When it freezes. Water does, and it has to crack.
Foyanini starts drilling a hole with an auger in the ice to make sure it's thick enough to fish on. He sticks his boot down in the hole and feels the thickness with his toe. 4 inches is recommended, but Foyanini says this pond is a foot thick and we're safe to fish. His friend, Guy Scarpelli, drags a sled out with the fishing gear. Soon, we've got some balls of Velveeta cheese on hooks, and Foyanini sits in a chair twitching them to attract fish. While we wait, Scarpelli tells me about an accident he had out here a few years back.
Well, I was right over there, and I didn't realize I was getting closer to where the spring had been, and the ice wasn't very thick. Next thing I knew, I fell through. And the thing that saved me was having Larry with me.
Yeah.
We lost the auger and everything.
Really?
Whoop.
How did you get him out?
I just laid out, flattened myself out on the ice where I was really flat, so I was distributing the weight and inched over towards him, and it still took us about 5-10 minutes to
really
finally got a leg up where I could grab it.
Neither of these guys is new to the sport either. Scarpelli started fishing on Seminole Reservoir near Rollins when he was a little kid back in the 1950s. But he says the sport has changed since then.
It's a shorter season, yes. And I ice fished on April 23rd and still had 16 inches of ice. But I've also seen it where, like last year, I didn't feel that we were safe enough to go out fishing.
Foyanini agrees. He grew up in Rock Springs and remembers getting on the ice in October. Now he says he's lucky if it's December. Meteorologist Sean Sublett worked on a report called On Thin Ice for the research group Climate Central. He says that's because fall is lasting longer than it once did.
We don't get the extreme cold as much as we used to.
Cheyenne used to feel the bite of 25 below pretty regularly, but Sublett says it hasn't dropped that low since 1990.
We're seeing a little bit of a delay in Arctic air kind of coming into the Rocky Mountains. I see delay in terms of, you know, some of these colder outbreaks would begin to settle in late October or November, and now they're waiting into later November or December.
Rocky Mountain winter is now as much as 3 degrees warmer than it was a century and a half ago. Nighttime, when ice forms fastest, has warmed up 5 degrees in that time. Sublett says some lakes that used to freeze, like around Salt Lake City, they just don't anymore. He says such trends make ice more dangerous to walk or drive a truck on for fishing.
With the ice not getting as thick, it's a little more risky. Unfortunately, you know, you fall through that ice and you're into that just hideously cold water, and, you know, hypothermia can set in a matter of minutes.
The Wyoming Game and Fish Department's Sarah DiRenzo has some advice for safer ice fishing. Look at the color.
Clear ice is much stronger than cloudy or white ice. Cloudy or white ice means that it's been frozen and then thawed and refrozen, and that can create some instability because of air bubbles or frozen snow. And so if you are fishing on white ice, we recommend double the thickness of 8 inches.
She says people should never try to ice fish alone and should make sure that they take some essential safety gear.
Ice picks, we recommend a life jacket in some cases, and definitely packing extra clothes and hot liquids in case there is an ice fishing accident.
She also says not to fish on places like streams or rivers with a current flowing underneath because that ice is even less stable. Meanwhile, out on the pond, a fishing pole goes crazy. Someone has nabbed our cheese. Poyanini lets me do the honors.
Okay, whoa. Lift him out.
Okay.
All the way out.
Whoa.
Oh, your first fish.
What do I do?
Just lay him on the ground.
Lay him on the ground?
That's a rainbow.
The ice might be getting less reliable, but the trout are still down there swimming. Scarpelli, for one, isn't giving up anytime soon.
Here, fishy, 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 fishy.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Wyoming author C.J. Box, who writes the best-selling Joe Pickett series, is an avid fly fisherman, and he has been taking his daughters fishing for as long as they can remember. Back in 2013, he sat down at StoryCorps with his daughter Molly Donnell to talk about their favorite fishing memories.
The first memory I have, it wasn't actually fishing, but you and your twin sister, Becky, thought it was. And I think you were probably 3 or 4, and I got you some Mickey Mouse fishing poles. And we used to live in town in Cheyenne, and after a big heavy rain, I took you guys out on the front sidewalk and showed you how to put the line. I think they were little rubber balls on the end that put the rubber balls in the water, and then I would cheer as you caught imaginary fish, and both of you really got excited about that. And I thought it kind of laid out my secret plan for the rest of my life and yours, and that was to raise girls who fished. So after that, you kind of got the hang of it, and then I got you a little bit bigger rods. And I remember taking both of you up into the mountains outside of Cheyenne when you were really young and tying on flies and bubbles because you could really wing those things out there. And I remember the first time we did that, and both of you weren't too sure that it was going to be fun. There were some boys up there. Some other family came up, and the boys were teasing you. Couldn't believe girls could fish, and you guys started catching fish after fish and outfished them. And you were so excited about that, and so was I. And I think, you know, I remember one of those little boys at one point grabbed a snake, because he thought if he couldn't outfish you, he would scare you to death. So he came running over with a snake. He didn't realize you guys like snakes, and you didn't do anything. You threw it back at him, and then they left in disgust. And I remember driving home, both of you being so excited that you not only outfished him, but you also outsnaked him. And I was very proud.
I can say from my perspective, growing up as a girl and having a dad that never at any point made me feel like I was lacking in anything or missing out on anything has been wonderful for me to discover how wonderful fly fishing is. And it's one of my favorite things to do. And I've had the ability to work in fly shops and kind of be one of the boys and always get that respect immediately from men in a field that is almost entirely dominated by men, and to show that women are just as good, and I agree, sometimes even better at the kind of finesse that is required. So, you know, we had some great trips and misadventures. Do you remember the Red Canyon Ranch and the sugar fish debacle?
Yes, yes. Your sister and I and you went fishing on the Poposia River right outside the ranch that we were staying at. And I think it was the first time that Becky, your sister, ever caught a fish on a grasshopper fly. And it's pretty exciting when you catch them on a grasshopper fly because they're on the surface and you see the fish take it. And she was able to land it, and it was probably about a 14-inch, you know, native trout. And she was so excited that you both wanted to eat it rather than put it back, which is what we usually do. And I agreed, let's do that. First big fish on a grasshopper. And we went back to the ranch that night. And I said, I would cook it for you. And I filleted it, and I got oil, and I thought that I put flour on it. I got a canister and dumped it in there, and then fried the fish up and gave it to you guys, and you both started saying how horrible it was. And I realized that I'd put the fish in powdered sugar instead of flour, and we started calling it. And then Becky was so mad at me and at the rancher because he kept referring to her sugar fish. And I pretty much ruined the whole experience for you guys. But the fact is, we did get some nice photos of the fish before I dipped it in sugar and screwed it up.
I know, too, as kids, that it was always really important for me to make you proud and be really tough on all the trips that we went on. On those trips, it was always very important to me to keep up and always keep fishing, because I always remember that was the goal. Even if we fished for 8-10 hours in a row, fishing was what we were there to do, and that's what we were focused on. And one trip that always kind of stuck out with me is I remember I was trying to be kind of a girly girl, and I was wearing flip-flops, and you were telling me as we were driving out there that that wasn't a good idea and to put on some more sensible shoes, but I decided I was going to fish in flip-flops that day, and we parked the truck and got out and were prepared to hike miles and miles down the river, and the first stream I crossed, it took my flip-flop off, and we all just watched it float down river, and I was very upset and didn't know what to do, and I think I threw out the idea of maybe going back and getting me another pair of shoes, and you said, well, I gave you the option to put on some different shoes, and you chose to wear flip-flops, and we're not going back to get them, so your options are to sit in the truck all day or to just keep fishing with us. And I remember I wanted to be tough, and fishing was the most important thing to me, and I spent all day fishing and hiking with one shoe. And
I was impressed, although one thing I do remember very distinctly about that is the three of us all looking downriver and watching your little yellow flip-flop float away. But no, you stuck with it, and that's not easy to do. And I guess that's one time when I realized, you know, your passion for fishing was more than just trying to make me happy, that you really do and did like it.
Because I even remember stepping in like moose and elk scats, yep, and just kept going.
Squishing it between your toes.
Yeah. But I caught some fish that day, so it was successful.
That's CJ Box and his daughter Molly Donald talking at StoryCorps in Cheyenne. The piece was produced by Irina Zhoroff and David Graff. And this isn't just the end of this episode, it's the end of this show as you know it. The show will relaunch in September, and instead of a digest of stories like you've been hearing, each episode will bring you one brand new long-form story exploring the Western experience. Melody Edwards will be your new host, and to hear the new show, you'll need to resubscribe in September. Just search for The Modern West wherever you download your podcasts. And we'll have a trailer on this feed later in the summer to remind you, too. Whether you've been listening to The Modern West since we launched or you just started listening, thanks for your time and your ears, and I hope you enjoy the new show when it relaunches. David Graff produced this episode, Anna Rader is our web editor, the theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.